Welcome to the Cop Doc Podcast. This podcast explores police leadership issues and innovative ideas. The Cop Doc shares thoughts and ideas as he talks with leaders in policing, communities, academia, and other government agencies. And now, please join Dr. Steve Morreale and industry thought leaders as they share their insights and experience on the Cop Doc Podcast.
Hi, everybody. This is Steve Morreale, and you're listening to the Cop Doc Podcast. I'm coming to you from Boston, and I have the pleasure to have my guest today, Dr. Renee Mitchell. Dr. Renee Mitchell is a retired Sacramento sergeant, Sacramento Police Department, 22 years. She is a pracademic, as I call myself, now working for RTI International, and she also is the founder of the American Society of Evidence-Based Policing. So we're going to be talking to her today in North Carolina. We just spoke a moment ago off mic, where she indicated that she had moved from the east, from the West Coast to the East Coast. And so let's talk about that again for a moment. How are you adapting? You've got snow now.
I do. I actually loved it. My kids, we all went outside. I think one of my kids was still in shorts. I think we're the only family in North Carolina that walks around in, 48 degree, weather with shorts on. I'm fully clothed in, sweats and tights and boots and scarves, but my husband and children still are like, it's not that cold.
It isn't. We adapt. Well, that is funny because when you go to, because I just came back from South Carolina, the same thing happens. We're walking the beach at 50, 60. It's no big deal for us. No big deal. And everybody else has their hats and their mittens and their mukluks on. And I think it's not 50 degrees. But anyway, everything is different. So I'm so glad to have you on the podcast. You come with so much experience, and I presume if you're like me, you're still in a state of learning. You're an attorney. You went to the University of Cambridge and got your PhD, and now you're doing research. Let's talk about that for a moment. What are you engaged in?
So one of our biggest projects that we have going on right now at RTI International is a large project funded by Arnold Ventures. We're working with seven cities within the Carolinas. So six of them are in North Carolina and one's in South Carolina. And it stemmed out of an article we wrote about, defunding the police, because that's been a big national conversation in the last year about reallocating the policing budget to other city services. And the assumption that we have is that if you're reallocating police services or the budget somewhere else, it's that you're trying to reduce police citizen contact, and you're putting some of those calls, that call responsibility, to someone else in the city. But it seemed like, from what you're seeing in the media, social media, is the cities were doing this without giving thought to like how this was going to be done. So our article was really about like a step-by-step process of using both data and the research to really drive, if you were going to make those decisions, like to have a more in-depth understanding about how you're going to make those decisions, what those decisions were going to look like, and then how to test out whatever you were going to decide to do, like how to test it to see if it actually is more effective and more efficient and was getting you the outcomes that you wanted. So with these seven cities, that's what we're in the process of doing right now, is we're just at the beginning of looking at all their calls for service data to examine, what is it that the officers are responding to? Where are your like repeat calls for service locations? Where are your repeat calls for service people? What are your highest rates of arrests and or mental health issues? There's just a recent article by David Weisberg talking about how mental health is higher. There's higher rates of depression and PTSD among your crime hotspots versus your areas that don't have as much crime. And using a mental health clinician along with a community engagement officer to you know, work those areas compared to other areas. And the response from the community was really, they liked both parts of it, right? So they have the mental health component to make sure that the community is getting the services they need, but they also like the public safety part, because if you live in a high crime area, you can't essentially treat one without the other. You can't give mental health services and say, well, gosh, I hope your depression's better. I hope your PTSD is better, but you still have gunshots at night, or you still can't walk to the grocery store and feel safe. You know, you have to work on both issues at the same time if you're working at helping a community, you know, have better mental health outcomes due to violence in the neighborhood.
Well, you know, it is certainly a common theme that's coming up. And in the next few weeks, I'll be talking to somebody named Sarah Abbott, Dr. Sarah Abbott, and she is responsible for advocates. And she is a clinician who is putting these clinicians in police vehicles with police officers. So I think that is certainly a trend coming. Let me go back to something. I remember many years ago, I saw you on a TED Talk, which drew my attention to you. I remember calling you. You were in Sacramento, and I was traveling back and forth to California. We were supposed to connect and we never did. But since that TED Talk, and certainly that TED Talk attracted some attention to you, and you have been outspoken. But can we talk about leadership, police leadership at all levels, and the state of policing today? And in your view, what are the things that police should be focusing on, police leaders, to try to stay ahead of these discussions about defunding and calling into question police legitimacy and procedural justice issues? What comes to mind?
That's a really tough question, because I often think I might answer your question without like answering your question, or it might sound that way anyway, because I think it's a little tough, because when I look back and I watch what happened in this last year, the media's portrayal of policing and the issues that occur, sometimes I look at the circumstances, and if people don't work in policing, they don't have an understanding of like the politics that go along with policing. And I wonder how much they realize that a lot of these decisions are a lot of policy are really driven by your cities, right? Your city management, your city councils. And I think when it comes to looking at the research, looking at data, we are an ill-prepared profession for how far we had advanced since, what would that be, the 80s and the 90s, when we first started actually using a little bit of data to drive policing. And when it comes to evidence-based policing, that's only been since the 90s that we've even had evidence-based policing. And I don't think people realize that when it comes to research in policing, there's been research on police practices, but as far as looking at what works in the field, as far as patrol techniques, all these different techniques, we're not as advanced as, say, evidence-based medicine is. So ultimately, I feel when it comes to police leadership, one of the only ways of really being able to have more credibility in some of these discussions is to get away from that this is how we've always done it. I think you have to have much more research to back up what you're doing and why you're doing it. For example, the riot and crowd control, like cities are starting to take away the tools that police officers are allowed to use in the field for riot and crowd control. And if you don't have something that demonstrates an unbiased empirical evaluation that says, here is the best way of handling these situations, you're going to be hard pressed to go before your city council and say, here's why we should still be using these things, because it looks bad, right? So I guess in a sense, I think one, we need to catch up on our research. Two, I think these are all systems within systems. So I think our leadership are hard pressed because they're confined within a box of politics that drives policing. So when you have the administrations, both Republican and Democratic administrations, that don't put funding behind police research or criminal justice research, you're not beginning the supply of information and knowledge that police leaders actually need. And then when you have city managers and city leaders that don't have a thorough and in-depth understanding of both data analysis and the research on policing, they're driving policy within their cities without a thorough understanding of policing and the criminological research behind it. It's a system problem, and police leadership, it shouldn't be on their back. And I feel like that's what social media and media does, is they keep saying, oh, police, 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 but nobody looks at the systems that police work within and how they're limited by the statutes that we have within our state, the city ordinances that they're confined by, and then the politicians within their both their cities and their state that require of them certain policies, practices, and what have you. So I think it's just really complicated. And I think the only thing that police leaders nowadays really can do is be very well educated on like a research base. So they can point to something that is not just their opinion and not just a neighboring agency either. You could no longer say, well, I'm doing what LAPD does because it has no ground to stand on unless LAPD's policies and practices are grounded in some type of research somewhere.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think that that's the mistake we make when we are always looking for best practices. And some of those best practices are not grounded in research and evidence. And I think there's a couple of things that come to mind when you're talking about it. I think police have gone through some mission creep. And I think as leaders, my sense is we have to take a look, and the data will tell you what kinds of calls are we going on and how much time is being spent. And is the police officer the person who should have to go to that? Think about the things they used to do when you started. You went on dog calls, you did lockouts and all of those kinds of things. And at some point in time, we started to back away from that. We backed away because we're sworn officers and we have other things to do. But I also think in terms of police reform and police reform that has been pushed through so many legislatures. And that's troubling because it's been forced through. In other words, there hasn't been time given to these reforms. But now you said something that really struck, and that is that there is not funding going to police research. When we think about how much money is put into medical research and think about how much money has been thrown at COVID for very good reason, but police research and understanding what we do is pushed to the side. So how do we make the argument that this is necessary?
I don't know. This is one of my arguments I've made for a long time. I have a bar chart that I've shown before that within the federal funding of how little funding goes to the criminal justice system when it comes to research for the criminal justice system, for the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the different agencies that really supply the information to the criminal justice system to fund the research that the academics do in conjunction with the police department. So the only way to increase that funding is for somebody to show that the criminal justice system actually impacts our society when it comes to finances so much more than anything. And like I've always said, I make a joke with the American Society of Evidence-Based Policing because we're a membership organization, but we also, besides being a membership organization, we run a conference every year and we would love to be able to fundraise the way other people or other groups do. But I don't have sick moms. I don't have puppies. With crime, there's nothing emotional about raising money for solving crime issues, right? Because especially now, nobody really cares for the cop. But then even on the criminal justice end, so unless you're raising money to help people specifically to the Innocence Project or things like that, that really pull at people's heartstrings, you're not going to be able to raise money to say, I really want to do police research so I understand the complexities of poverty and crime and violence and how police interact with these communities and how police should better interact with these communities and how best to balance having investigatory stop versus community engagement and the best way to engage with your BIPOC community versus other types of community or non-English speaking communities versus a university type community, because we have different types of communities all across the U.S. But how do you not that you're competing, but it's different when you have a 5K fundraiser for survivors of breast cancer. There's when I say sick moms, I don't mean to denigrate or demean the importance of that, but you have had somebody in your life that usually probably has had cancer and that you want to go out and run a 5K because you want to fight against leukemia. You want to fight against breast cancer. Nobody could really say, well, I'm going to go run a 5K because I want to understand crime in
right.
high poverty areas, or
I do.
It's just really difficult. So the funding, but if you look at the impact in society when it comes to the financial costs of having children in foster care, having the juvenile justice system, having our recommendations for what we see, how to alleviate some of these problems. I don't even know if this has changed. I have yet to see outcomes for DUIs or anything drug related. It was always back in the day of go to a 12-step program of people getting like their 12-step meeting signed off for when they had a DUI. Well, 12-step programs don't have an evidence base. I know I'll probably get hate tweet of I've been in recovery for this long and I go to a 12-step program. But when they look at the overall impact to the average community member dealing with a drug and alcohol issue, AA and NA is not an evidence-based program. And there's like medically assisted treatment programs that have been proven to work,
right.
You know, and then they're slowly coming to the US. They're more dominant in the UK and areas over in Europe and the Netherlands that shown success over there. But coming over to the US, we don't use them. So it's just like, it should be funded at a greater and given greater weight than it has been. But I don't know how you change that other than by doing this, by vocalizing the fact that it should be funded at a higher rate than it is currently.
The same problem seems to run with training. Training is the first thing that goes away. If we've got a problem with money, we're going to put the training. Think about in-service training and in some cases how subpar in-service training has become. Sometimes it's 40, it's moved back to 32, and only 12 of those hours has to be face-to-face and everything else is online. So training is sort of the giveaway, and that's a shame. And the fact is that there are no real training standards and national standards for policing. It's 18,000 police departments. Everybody does it differently. California does it different than Massachusetts. North Carolina does it different than Arizona. All of those things happen. And while we may not want federal intervention, I do wonder why there is not a national standard of training, because you alone know that some police officers are sworn in after a 12-week training and others a 30-week training. I have to scratch my head and say, what's missing between the 12-week and the 30-week? And then we turn these people out and they're bona fide police officers, but what the hell are we missing? I see you smiling. Right. I'm sorry, I'm able to see, the audience can't see you smiling, but what's your reaction to that?
Well, and I think to myself, like not even the training piece, it's that we don't even know if it works, right? And not that we got to have an academy, we definitely have an academy, but it's also when they use like for a solution, for instance, like implicit bias training, like we have no idea if that's actually an effective intervention to change behavior in cops. There's been, I think, one research study that finally came out, and I don't remember the results, but before any of this research has even started, it becomes, oh, cops need procedural justice training. Like whatever, I think Ed Flynn's been the one that's always said that the whatever the issues are in police training, the solution has always been like train the cops. It's never any different solution. But on the same sense, like what you're saying is there's no national standard of like what we're supposed to be learning or how we're supposed to be learning. And there's no institution to review any of this stuff to say, is what Arizona's learning versus New York, is it even reasonably close? Which has always been one of my pet peeves when people group policing, and I'm air quoting, people can't see it, as it's one thing, one profession altogether, because the way I'm trained in California doesn't mean that that's the way somebody's trained in Georgia. So comparing what a Georgia cop did and how they engaged on a traffic stop or how they engaged in their use of force could be completely different. And their use of force policy could be completely different than what mine is in California. Yet we're all grouped and judged across the U.S. as though we were one entity. And I don't
mean to cut you off, but I want to, you know, you're catching something with me. Imagine, so talk about standards, what we just did. Someone somewhere at one point in time said a college degree requires 120 credits. That's no different on the East Coast than it is on the West Coast. So imagine that in comparison with policing saying a police officer can go to an academy for 12 weeks and yet an LA cop or Sacramento, what was yours? Mine
Sacramento.
Was it 25 weeks or more? 26 weeks. That's a vast difference. And what is different? Why aren't there standards? And you know, you've spent time abroad and it's completely different. It's a singular or just a few police agencies, and they all are trained generally the same. And we have not done that here. I know we love local control, but that may be one of the issues.
Right. Well, and I think going across the pond, I've been over in Scotland and then in the UK and looking at there and even into New Zealand and Australia and looking at their models, they are different than us because they have much more federal control, right, than we do. And looking, and I am not dollar when it comes to any of our Constitution, Bill of Rights, any of that stuff. But if you look at how we were created, policing and the way we were structured, I kind of doubt that we could ever get to where they are because of our fear of having a national police and a federal police because of our history with Britain. So, but what I think we could do, there have been people before me that have called for this forever, but is a national college of policing, an American college of policing. So the UK has the UK College of Policing. So it's not that they're a federal entity of saying like, you shall do this. But what it is it's like a board of standards for all of the UK. And it has practitioners and academic on it. So you don't have just politicians or academics or people outside of the profession that are saying, this is what cops should be doing. You have practitioners in there and you have well-educated practitioners. You know, that's the other piece that tires them when they group policing all together or talk about police officers and they have a stereotype for police officers, especially the uneducated, untrained police officer, because both you and I don't fit that model. But that's who they have at the UK College of Policing, are these police officers that have been through rigorous master's and PhD level programs, contributing to the intellectual dialect of where UK policing should be headed. In the US, if you look at Lyndon B. Johnson's commission that he held in 1960, and I'm going to get the year wrong.
67.
Okay. Yep. So if you read through that, one of the things that commission came back with there, besides to increase our training, that was one of them. The other one, there was quite a few different pieces of, not advice, directives. And if you look at all of them, we did a really good job as a profession of trying to incorporate these into policing. One of the ones we never accomplished was everybody having a bachelor's degree. But the one we really failed at is it got the research in there because it said that police agencies should have a researcher, like large police agencies should have a researcher on staff. It said that there would be, this is how the National Institute of Justice was actually created, was through that commission. It was called something else at the beginning, but eventually became the National Institute of Justice. But they called for funding for research and for having not oversight, but for some other entity driving like this national standard. Under FEMA, there is a National Fire Management, which does the same thing like a UK College of Policing. So we could in the US have something similar to UK College of Policing. We could have an American College of Policing under a federal organization, like under FEMA, and what they do for the national, and I'm getting the name wrong, that doesn't sound right in my head, for the fire management. They do the research. They go out into the field. They figure out like what the firefighters should be doing, how they should be fighting fires. They put out that information to the field, but they're funded to do the research.
Right.
They're funded to go out to determine like how things should be running in the field. Now, it's up to individual cities to adopt those practices, but at least you have a dedicated, funded agency that is trying to stay the most advanced and current in the research for fighting fires. Mm-hmm. And in policing, we don't have something like that, right?
No.
Like if we had an American College of Policing, Gary Cordner's been talking about this, Larry Sherman's been talking about this. We actually got together a group of us to try to create the first American College of Policing and put a small board together and couldn't get any traction for it.
Right.
But you could have that same entity that was really driving these national standards and national conversations from an unbiased point of view to some extent, because they could stay away from the politic, the internal conflict. And if they were funded to do research, like we could be advancing policing much more than we are today.
A couple of things that just went through my mind. When we write research, especially that which is academic, is driven by evidence and with some scientific approach. It is very dense. It is very difficult to read. And what I've talked to a number of people who I have had the opportunity to interview is to say, how do we translate this? In other words, how do we make it so it's synthesized, it's easy to read, and it's usable? And it doesn't take 10 years to get from inception to reality. That's a tough thing. But I'm also thinking that another model to go by is the military. The military does tremendous, and they have contracts galore over leadership training and tactics training and what are we going to wear? All of those kinds of things are done within the military and paid for by the military. And yet policing is a paramilitary organization, so we say, but we do not adapt or adopt most of what is going on in the military. We could learn from the military, but we don't seem to.
No, we don't. And that's what I was saying is because the military has national funding, because they're under the feds, they get more funding to do their research. And I think they're also, I know people do not want to hear that the police are going to adopt anything from the military, but they also, like, a lot of the things the military do are to keep their people safe and to learn, like, some of the work that I've seen come out of the military over the last decade having to do with counterinsurgency has a lot to do with communication, because they're dealing with people on their own lands that speak a different language, that have a different culture, and that don't agree with the same ideology that Americans do. So how do you bridge that gap? And they've actually done the research to say, well, what works, not just guessing at it and saying, here's what we think works, but testing these things out. And like I said, I think that's where we fail a bit, is we don't have federal funding in that sense. Other than, I shouldn't make it seem like we don't have federal funding. There's federal funding that comes down through the OJP, like the Justice Institute, that then put out solicitations to the universities, to the research institutes like mine at RTI International, that you apply for, and then you could build your research around. But there's nothing that in the military they're getting directly funded, where if there was a national College of Policing, like, you could directly fund that in some sense with federal dollars and say, we're not this, and you could leave it where it's not affecting local agencies. Just like I said, with the fire management, you could say, here's what our research has found, but you're not telling a local agency that they have to do it, but they have access to the information. And like when you're saying about the research is usually dense, like that is something that ASCBP, that is our mission. Like, because we are all pracademics, you know, we're the practitioner academics that one of the things that we offer our members is to translate research. So we try to take, and we're not fully funded. Most of us are working full time and trying to run a nonprofit on the side. So we do the best we can with what we have, but we pull research articles that we think the cops would be interested in. And then we translate them. We narrow it down to about a 2-page paper if we can. And then what we usually do is run that paper by one of the authors to make sure that we didn't get the language we use. We want to make sure we didn't water it down, or that we didn't, some of our language isn't biasing it one side or the other. We want to make sure that we're accurately translating it. And once they say, yep, this is an accurate depiction of what my research does, then we post that. And we've been putting out these briefs for a couple years now, every 2 weeks. Some of the briefs, people are like, oh, thanks. And other briefs, people are like, oh, this is great. This is exactly what I was looking for. My agency is now looking into, it could be about training, it could be about hotspot policing. We just put one out the other day about crime data. That a lot of people really like that one, about how you look at crime data and what's the difference between looking at percents going up, percents going down versus other types of analyzing the data. So there's those issues too. And that's where I also think, because these are systematic issues that are so big and they are so impactful to our society, that I really think you need something like a College of Policing where you can have people examining all these issues and how they interlink. Because I don't think any one person, even myself, like the more I read and the more I learn, the more I realize I don't know much.
I feel the same way.
You know?
Yes.
Every step of my career, I feel like I'm just opening another door to be like, well, I didn't know that either. To have a group of people really driving it, like how to understand this better and how to make things work. And I think you need a lot of different people involved. I think you need economists. I think you need psychologists. I think you need cops. I think you need the academic to really dig into all of these issues to say, here's what we know in the research and here's what we think might work.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting, because as we're watching what's going on with the pandemic, who knew that public health would have so much power in our country because of what's going on? Look at the vaccination and how are we getting those out and who's making the decision. Somebody's making the decision. Power of the governor that have shut businesses down. It's pretty phenomenal. But my point is that when you're listening to the Dr. Fauci's of the world or whomever, they're always talking about data and they're always talking about, right? And that becomes important. That drives decision. You know, the science, look at the science. And I think that's what we're saying in this particular discussion. So if I asked you very quickly, I'm not running out of time, but I want you to think very quickly. Three things police organizations need to address quick. What would they be?
Probably no one would agree with me, but I actually think you have to address the issue of data management. I do think that if you look at Kahneman and Tversky's work about, we do not innately understand statistics. And I think my favorite quote, I think it was by Ben Goldacre, probably getting the person wrong, but they talked about the fact if your job depends on being numerate, on understanding data, then you have an ethical responsibility to understand data and statistics. And like I said, our profession has moved so quickly since the 90s when it comes to Comstat and to use data to drive our decision-making. But when you talk about leadership and you talk about the military, when the military puts leaders into positions, what does their training look like? Like it is fundamentally structured by rank and has very specific things that you're going to take and achieve and accomplish at each level.
Right. It's developing competencies.
Yes. And we do not have anything at a national level that develops competencies across rank for policing. Now we have the FBINA, which has a little bit of schooling in it, but there's nothing that says like, here's what you should know as a sergeant. Here's what you should know as a lieutenant. And I think one of those pieces is, especially as you get to a lieutenant level, because that's when you're starting to manage a district. And usually a lot of brand new lieutenants are out there managing field patrol.
Yes.
And if you don't understand data and you don't understand how data fluctuates and you don't understand how to compare data, and if you want to say that and most agencies nowadays are trying to say that they're data-driven, then you're often making decisions that affect your community based on information that you don't understand. So that's my first thing. And then secondly, like I said, I think the next piece is really getting a grasp of what we know and what we don't know about policing when it comes to the research. Because if you look across the country, we're still using programs and practices that have been debunked and have no evidentiary support for them. And we still have, you mentioned best practice, like I won't even use that term. I just call it common practice, because our version of best practice is if three agencies use it, then it must be good. But that's fundamentally based on nothing, right? And then on the third part is, I think for the future of policing, you really do have to examine. I think you have to sit back, slow down, if your politicians will let you. And you got to go through like and ask your city and your community, like, what do you want from policing? Because like I was explaining, the calls for service project that we have going on here in North Carolina, I think to some extent, you know, every police agency across the country now wants to take some of the services from police and put it into another city service. But I don't know that anybody's asked the citizen. So when somebody's calling, and not on a 911 call, because that's not an appropriate place for it, but on a non-emergency service, would you rather have a city employee, a crisis counselor, somebody for a dispute resolution? You know, whatever those things may be, the options, right? Because I think sometimes people don't realize you may, as an outsider or even as a researcher, think, okay, that we don't want the cops going here anymore, these calls, right? But what about what the citizen wants? Because both you and I know that a lot of times when we've been out in the street, often we take a report that means nothing, that goes nowhere. But because a citizen wants it, that's the customer service we give them. We do that report for them, right?
Right.
So I wonder about the same thing for calls. If when a citizen wants a police officer, if they're sent a city employee, if that citizen's going to say, that's not what I want. I don't want a city employee. Like, I want a police officer. I want somebody here that makes me feel safe and secure, and whatever a police officer means to them. And a good example, and you have to do it more thoughtfully, because there was a great tweet the other day where they did an article, and it was somewhere in Canada where they essentially took police services away. They sent them to the city, and you have this coffee shop that's calling about one of the issues that they're having with their homelessness. And this police department said, sorry, we aren't allowed to go to those calls anymore. You have to call the city. And when they called the city said, oh, we don't know what to do with that call. And so then the coffee shop owner saying, well, then what do I do? Like, you won't send me a police officer anymore. You said the cops can't come to my coffee shop. Now you're telling me the city won't come help me. Now what do I do as a business owner? So I think those are the things that, one, you have to know in advance what your response is going to be, but also two, like, people pay taxes for a reason. And so in some ways, just the same way you and I would always get that whole, I pay your salary, right? And I mean, it's, we hated it. Yeah. But in some sense, like, this is the same problem that I think cities will face, is those same people on that other end of the phone, they might have that same reaction when you want to send them other services. They might say, I pay your salary. I want a police officer. I don't want that other service. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the other thing, is cities really have to define, what do you want your cops to do? What do you want city workers to do? What do you want health clinicians to do?
But Renee, the thing is, you're absolutely right, but it can't be a politician who is coming down with that edict, who is deciding for themselves. There have to be some sort of, exactly what you're saying, we have to survey the public and we have to ask those questions. What do you want? And that's exactly right. And it can't be anecdotal,
right?
It cannot be anecdotal. It has to, exactly. So let's ask the questions. Let's collect the data. Let's crunch the data and then let people know what we found. Because a lot of times when surveys are done, if they don't like, people who did the survey don't like it, they just don't release. And you've seen that before, right?
Yes,
I know.
So I think all of these questions, it and what I advocate for, is it's a very complex problem. And what bothers me about the media and what the conversation we have going on today is that so many people want to just say, here's the solution. And there isn't. There isn't a solution. There's learning and there's data to sort through and there's research to be done. And there's a lot of learning on a lot of different systems and people's part, but there's no one panacea that's going to solve this problem. So unless people start sitting back and actually dedicating the time and the resources to really understanding it and then creating solutions that work for the people living the problem, that we're going to be in the same. You talked, and I know we got to wrap up soon. You talked about like my TED Talk. That TED Talk 5 years ago, I was talking about the same thing we are today. And I had said, if we don't start changing things, we're going to be in the same boat 5 years from now. And I said that because what I saw from the Lyndon B. Johnson Commission is that commission, I felt, was right on with where they were directing policing. And had we actually followed through with that commission's recommendations, I think policing would be somewhere different. But I think we're so hell-bent on these programs of the day and the new acronym or the new exciting thing that's going to cure all in policing. I think we could be better off than we are today. And if we don't start examining the data and the research more thoroughly, we're going to be just as bad off.
If you look at that report and turn that report into potentially a strategic plan, and if you're going to be training in strategic planning, you have a plan, you have goal, you have a champion, and then you have an evaluation period. Is it working? Isn't it working? I actually think we need to go back and look at that 50-year-old report, see what we did, see what we didn't, fast forward, maybe create another commission to say, okay, what have we done? What did we miss? What has to happen today? Because the question that is burning with me, yourself being an academic now, a researcher now, but coming from the field, are police bad?
I don't think so. Like when I look at, this is what makes me sad, is because I think that you have all this, I think there are dollars being thrown at all these organizations that are saying that they're going to reform cops. And when I look at these organizations, where are your cops? And that's why I'm always advocating for ASCVP, because I feel like we're the cops that are advocating a very solid plan in some sense to change the trajectory of policing. And when I look at the cops around me, I think to myself, all of these people want policing to be better. They want it to be more than it is, and they don't want bad cops. But yet, that's all that gets highlighted in the world is every time a cop missteps. And that's the thing, they don't do that to doctors, not malpractice. Like the mistakes that are made in medicine are in the hundreds of thousands. They've shown like implicit bias within the medical profession and the deaths that accumulate within the medical profession, but yet it's somehow it's a moral judgment on police officers for us as a whole in totality of our profession. So like
it's a generalization,
right? So if a doctor is a bad doctor and goes into a surgery drunk and accidentally kills somebody because he makes a mistake, you don't hear about everybody saying all doctors are bad. They're all have these horrible
We need to
ethics.
Reform the medical profession. Right.
Right. It's that doctor. And so that doesn't happen in our profession. It becomes that all police, what's the acronym, ACAB, that all, you know, cops are bastards. It becomes all of us. I've seen that on Twitter, you know, I don't know one good cop. I don't know any cop that is a good person because they're in a system that's a racially based system. So there can be no good cops. So all I know are a bunch of people that got into the profession because they want to make a difference. And I think over the decades, like if you look at the profession, I think we try really hard to get better at what we do and to learn from our mistakes and to change our policies and our practices and to look at ourselves and do better. I've often heard if you look at the way we've improved versus other professions, sometimes I think we have advanced more than other professions have because one, we're in the limelight, but two, like we try hard and we mean well.
That's good to hear. I want to throw a couple of curveballs at you as we get ready to wrap up. The first question is, what books are you reading? Where do you look for information to expand your horizons other than policing books?
I don't read policing books. I think the last time I ran out of something to read, like I went on Twitter and I asked, hey, does anybody have any recommendations for reading? Don't suggest any policing books because I don't read those. So usually I actually read psychology books. And then lately, I actually probably am in copyright violation because I think I've almost tweeted all of Adam Grant's Think Again book. It just got released like 3 days ago and I've been reading it and I love the quotes out of it. But the books I enjoy the most that I think actually are really good for police leadership are usually the ones that challenge our way of thinking. So Annie Duke's Thinking and Bet, I think, is a great book. My all-time favorite, my hero, is Dr. Kahneman. So his Thinking Fast and Slow, his work with Tversky, because I think ultimately that is probably also why I got into police research is our intuition about what we think is going to happen in the world and then how human beings really react, two totally different things, right? What we think human beings are going to do and then when we test our assumptions, usually are wrong. We don't get it right half the time. So his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, really lays out this framework for why we think the way we think, why we struggle with statistics. And I actually, to really geek out, I think some of the best books I've read that I think a lot of policing leaders should actually read are on statistics. So The Signal and the Noise by Nate Silver, and then How Not to Be Wrong by Jordan Ellenberg are two of the statistics books that I usually, because they're not written, they're not like a textbook for college. They're written as every day. They got the interesting stories in them, fun to read. They kind of have that Malcolm Gladwellian stories to them, yes, but they're teaching you about psychology. Yes. And then I also really like Atul Gawande's writing. So he wrote, I actually think Being Mortal has nothing to do with leasing, but that's a good one for any human being to read. But his book—
Well, don't police officers have to realize that they're mortal? They're not immortal?
That is true. And it's a great book about death, you know, being human beings. But I think for policing, his Checklist Manifesto, I think it's something for police leadership because he talks about when you're under pressure or stress, because he comes from the medical profession, that having like a checklist, and he's done a lot of work. A lot of his writing is centered around how to reduce accidents in the medical field. So he writes about if you create checklists, it helps you not to make mistakes. I've always thought there's got to be things in policing that we could bring checklists into and use them. So those are—
Well, we certainly use, imagine a pilot operating a plane without a checklist. It's the same sort of a thing.
He's another one that I like. So all of it's funny, most of the authors that I read center around all of the same ideas to some extent. It's usually how to make their professions better, how to rethink their professions, whether it's a medical field or the psychology. And it's also about human behavior, because I think we really, probably just in the last 30 years or so, are starting to understand education and learning so much better. We don't even understand exactly the way we learn best. The whole learning styles, that's a myth that's been busted with research, but that's still something that we pass around in the academies, is saying that we have learning styles. So those are off the top of my head.
The last question, if you had a choice or a chance to sit down with somebody of notoriety, not necessarily famous, dead or alive, to pick their brain, who might that
be? Oh, it'd be Daniel Kahneman.
Great.
Because his work is really, it's all about how our brains work. And he has this exceptional style of creating experiments that tapped into what he's examining and that I wish I could replicate in the field the way he does. So most of my experiments that I've run are patrol field experiments with cops, but I actually want to somehow switch a little bit into doing lab work where you can potentially do the same kind of work he's done, but figure out that how to reconstruct some of what we do in the field in the laboratory to really get at what is happening. We've been playing around with the idea of VR using scenarios and then changing things in the scenarios to see how people react. So he would be somebody that I would love to sit down and just talk to and say, how do you construct your experiments? And do you have your question first and then walk back your experiment? Or do you just surround yourself with people and kind of bounce your ideas until it finally just somehow forms that nugget in your brain and you figure it all out?
Well, thank you. Thank you for your time today. Glad to have another person who's on the East Coast, even though you're a transplant with us. I applaud you for what you're doing. And I know that the Society of Evidence-Based Policing is something that you and others worked to put together, but I think it helped focus exactly what you're talking about, that we become more data-driven and help people understand what that means. So thank you, Renee, very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. Hope to have you back again. I want to sign off by saying this is Steve Morielli in Boston. You've been listening to the Cop Doc podcast and Dr. Renee Mitchell. Hey, everybody, a few things before you leave. First, thanks for listening. I'm so gratified to see the downloads rising in the last few months, not only from the U.S., but from across the globe. It's surprising and humbling to find students, colleagues, and practitioners listening. We have a growing number of listeners in Canada, Ireland, England, Northern Ireland, Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Germany, and Colombia. We appreciate your time and energy and welcome feedback. Please feel free to reach out to me by email at copdoc.podcast@gmail.com. That's copdoc.podcast@gmail.com. Check out our website at copdocpodcast.com. Please take the time to share our podcast with your friend if you find value in the discussions. We've had so many amazing guests and more to come who have shared their wisdom, their thoughts, their viewpoints, and their innovative ideas. Most importantly, a huge thank you to those of you who show up for work in policing every day, not knowing the kinds of calls that you'll be sent on or the kinds of situations you'll find yourself in. You risk your lives for people, many of whom you don't know. And for that, we owe you a debt of gratitude, a big thanks. Hope you stay safe, healthy, and look forward to hearing from you, and hope you'll continue to listen to upcoming episodes of the Cop Doc podcast. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to the Cop Doc podcast with Dr. Steve Morielli. Steve is a retired law enforcement practitioner and manager turned academic and scholar from Worcester State University. Please tune into the Cop Doc podcast for regular episodes of interviews with thought leaders in policing.
Before you go, if you'd like to reach out, comment, provide feedback, or have a topic that could be considered to explore in the future, contact me via LinkedIn, Facebook, or send me an email at copdoc.podcast@gmail.com. That's copdoc.podcast@gmail.com. Stay tuned for upcoming episodes where we'll be talking with a distinguished professor from Virginia Commonwealth University, the former commissioner of the Boston Police Department, and the academic director of the Baltimore Police Academy, to name just a few. I'm very happy now that the Cop Doc podcast is listed on Law Enforcement Today's podcast network. Among other police-related podcasts I'd recommend, when you have time, I suggest you take time to listen to Law Enforcement Today Radio with Jay Wiley. You might also listen to Pat Fitzgibbons on his podcast, The CJ Evolution, or Policing Matters from Police One with Jim Dudley. You can find links to these recommended police-related podcasts on our website at www.copdocpodcast.com. Intermittently, you'll hear from me in micro-podcasts called Reflections and Ruminations on Leadership. These short pieces will raise leadership and organizational issues and discuss problems and practices, as well as the elements of leadership for you to consider. I look forward to continuing to talk with colleagues in the field of policing, criminal justice think tanks, community, academics, and researchers. And for those of you still in the trenches, I wish you my best and implore you to stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you for what you do to keep our community safe. This is Steve Morielli in Boston. Thanks so much for listening to the Cop Doc podcast.